It worked.
Merlin?
Yes.
Is it really you?
I think so.
David Warner stars in T.H. White's classic take on the King Arthur myth.
Without going into what might happen when newfangled theories about time and relativity collide with old-fashioned necromancy, let's just say that I'm here for a few hours.
I'd forgotten how difficult having a conversation with you can be.
And I thought you might be pleased to see me again.
The Once and Future King, on Sunday, the 9th of November, at 3 o'clock, and available for 30 days afterwards on the BBC Radio 4 website.
The Drama of the Week is a download from the BBC.
Will passengers for Qantas flight number QF102 to Wellington please proceed to Gate B? BAC regret to announce that flight BA113 to London will be delayed.
Hello.
Good morning, Phil. I'm looking for Mr. Foster.
What do you want?
The chap on the BOAC desk suggested I should speak with Mr. Foster.
I'm Brian Foster.
It's a rather unusual request, I'm afraid. One that I suspect I should have dealt with before.
Name?
Rushton. R-U-S-H-T-O-N. William George Rushton. W-G, like Grace, the cricketer.
W-G Rushton. Passenger inquiry. Referral. B-O-A-C. Take a seat, Mr. Rushton. 1st of July, 1968. Travelling?
From Sydney to London.
British citizen?
Yes, indeed.
And the nature of the inquiry?
It's about this. Oh, I shouldn't try and open it if I were you.
What is it?
Sad to say, it's Hancock's ashes.
Hancock?
Yes.
Is that a dog's name? Yes. Right. They're coming here. Now, how long will that be? Right. Yes. You stay here.
Oh.
That was the military police. Said they'd be here in half an hour or so. Hello? Daniel? You awake? Not going crook on me? Right. Deserter. An AWL from Victoria Barracks. Just give me a minute to sort this out. I'll find if I log everything, it obviates subsequent confusion. Your flight's going to be another hour at least. He's practically catatonic in there. Hard to work out whether he's sick or just lying doggo. We get a lot of them, bastards. You'll have to excuse me a minute, Mr. Rushton. We're two men down on the shift, so I'm basically running the whole bloody airport on my own. I've got Danny, the deserter, in the luggage room, and a sick man in the nurse's station. You all right in there, Mr. Powell? So, if we could cut this short. Hello. Hilly. No, I can't talk about this now, Hilly. No, you'll have to phone back in 10 minutes or so. No, I realise it's something we've got to talk about. Yes, phone me. Phone me back in 10 minutes. Right, this is about your dog's ashes.
No, not my dog. These are the ashes, the last mortal remains of Hancock. Tony Hancock.
A person?
Yes, Tony Hancock.
And was Mr. Hancock a relative?
The Tony Hancock.
You say that as if it's somebody I should have heard of.
Hancock's half hour? Anthony Aloysius St. John Hancock of Railway Cuttings team?
No, I don't know.
A pint? That's very nearly an armful. From the television.
I don't have a television.
Ah, I see.
My sister's always on about us getting one, but from what I can see, the news is all lies, and the rest is just girls dancing around in their underthings.
If memory serves, girls in their underthings never loomed large in Hancock shows.
What did he do? Singer?
He was a comedian.
Oh.
A very well-respected comedian.
People laughed at him, did they?
Yes, very much so.
And he encouraged that?
Whenever possible, yes.
He liked it when they laughed.
I'd say it was the object of the exercise. among television viewers, a growing band, I think you'll agree, even though you prefer not to be of their number, he was regarded with nothing less than reverence. Sadly, a couple of weeks ago... Oh, you must have seen something in the newspaper.
Right.
He took his own life.
I'm sorry to hear that.
And here's the problem, you see. The chap on the BOEC desk was unwilling to let me take the remains on board.
It's perfectly in order for the remains to be taken on the flight, Mr. Rushton, as long as they travel cargo in the hold.
That's what the chap on the BOEC desk said. But I would, if possible, prefer to keep them with me as cabin luggage.
That would be in breach of regulations, Mr. Rushton. So, if that was your only inquiry...
The last time I travelled by BOEC, while I was drinking in the glories of Rome, my luggage was gathering an icy rime in Reykjavik. If the ashes were to get lost...
Let me reassure you, Mr. Rushton. Australian baggage handling is the envy of the world. They're craftsmen, our lads. On top of that, all human remains, including ashes, go with the fragile and out-of-gauge baggage, which means they'll be kept in the luggage room over there until your flight's being loaded, then they'll be taken out to the plane and placed by hand, safely and securely, in the hold. There is no chance they'll get lost.
There is also the matter of respect. Whether living or deceased, it's not seemly for a man of Hancock's calibre to spend 26 hours in the bowels of a 707.
I'm afraid on this matter the rules are quite clear.
What I don't understand is...
What?
If you could indulge my curiosity for a moment, I don't quite understand why the regulation's there in the first place.
I don't make the rules, Mr. Rushton. These things are drawn up by experts in the field of aircraft safety and passenger comfort.
It's just... I can't imagine what risk there could possibly be.
Spillage.
Spillage?
Spot of turbulence at 30,000 feet, the urn falls open. It's a pressurised cabin, circulated air. Travellers don't want cremated remains stuck up their noses and scattered on their complimentary heated meals.
It's a screw top. I think it's even sealed with wax or glue or something.
And there's the matter of taste. Passengers might find it ghoulish.
Don't follow.
People don't want to be reminded of the transience of their existence when they're 30,000 feet up in the air.
Nearer, my God, to thee.
Creamy ashes go cargo, no exceptions. What? Who? Oh. I'll tell him. Right. The door is there, Mr. Rushton. Nothing I can do. Good day. Wake up. Danny. Wake up. I've just had your commanding officer on the phone. He's been talking to your parents and he wants me to tell you you've broken your mother's heart. Is that the plan? No. Expect you thought the misery you'd bring to your loved ones by being a traitor to Queen and country would be nothing compared to what they'd feel if you were blown up in a Vietnam paddy field with your boots half a mile from your helmet. I'll go to swinging London, you thought. I'll drink some cocktails and do the twist till some other blokes have won the war for me, and then I'll come home all forgiven and forgotten. Well, bend your ears to some facts and figures, Sonny Jim. There's a less than 1% chance you'll come home from Vietnam in a box. That's a fact. Would you say that's lower odds or higher odds than the chance you'll catch a dose from some Chelsea-set dolling bird in swinging London? And how do you think that's going to make your mother feel every Anzac Day when she stands alongside all the other mothers who are proud to grieve? Eh? And they turn to your mother and say, how did your son die? And she has to hang her head in shame and tell him you died of a social disease on the floor of a Carnaby Street wobble palace. Eh? VC or VD, Sonny Jim? That's the... What's been going on here? Did you do this? I check these locks every night. Right, stay. Sit down. I said sit down. Now, Danny, you're not going to kill yourself, are you?
I wonder...
Stop it!
Bloody keys. Get after him. He's locked us in. Why didn't you stop him?
I'm afraid I have the reactions of a salted slug.
Hello, Lance. My bloody deserter got away. Yeah, took my keys. You need to put out a general alert and get people on all the exits. Yeah, that's right. He locked me in here. There's a spare set of keys in Pat Lacey's office. Big grey filing cabinets, top drawer, the one on the extreme right. Yeah, quick as you can, mate. A bit
broke the lock on the window. Lord knows how.
Ooh, there's blood on your...
Bastard pushed me over.
No, you stay there.
There's a first aid kit and a nurse's station. Have a look at Mr. Powell while you're in there.
Here.
Opposite the door.
Excuse me. Mr. Powell, is it? I won't be a moment.
How's he looking in there?
He managed to smile. Very pale. It isn't some...
No, it's nothing catching. Bit of a bellyache. Yeah. Did a fart at the Pan Am desk. Followed through.
Yeah, but for the grace of God.
Amen. Is there some iodine in there? Something?
This?
Yeah, that'll do.
No, let me.
Ah!
Sorry.
No, it just stings a bit.
What will they do with Danny the deserter?
These days, who knows? Old country crawling with draft dodgers and runaways, and the police just turn a blind eye. I mean, say what you like about the Yanks, but they know how to keep discipline. You catch a deserter, you shoot him.
Not here, though.
Likely as not, they'll give him a telling off and send him home to Mum. Or find him psychologically unsuitable, I ask you. Half the men I served with in the war were off their rockers. Kept you awake at night with their barking, but apart from that, nice as ninepence.
Is this lad showing symptoms?
Low from his base, said he went round all day with a face like a chook's ass and cried a bit. So do a lot of them.
I imagine if I was about to be shipped off to Vietnam, the man itching might give a bit of a wobble.
Cunning bastard must have been working at that window lock every time my back was turned. Plotting his escape and lying doggo when I went in. Saw his chance to blindside me when I was in there. One minute he's a crybaby lying there half catatonic, next he's a burko.
Should I stick one of these on?
Scrap of boracic and a bit of that tape should do the job. Lying there like he could hardly blink 1 minute, and then where'd he get the strength from? Bloke from the base said he was a bloody vegetarian.
Perhaps he was lying about his diet.
What?
We've all done it. I was told I should give up puddings.
Who told you that?
Everybody. Can't be done. People who think nicotine's addictive have never tasted custard. If the devil was interested in some sort of barter, my soul would be his for a bowl of steamed ginger pudding.
Yeah? I'm a creamed rice man myself.
Had a feeling you might be. Did I see a kettle in there?
Yeah, Vera usually does the honours, but she's off on a honeymoon. Actually, we're a good hour overdue for the morning brew, and Becky.
I'll be Vera then.
Ask Mr. Powell if he'd like one.
Mr. Powell? Mr. Sugar?
3 for me. There's a tin of condensed on the side there. The kettle's lost its whistle, I'm afraid. Vera wanted to get an electric, but I don't like the idea of the element being so close to the water. You can taste the electric in the tea.
Yeah. He's sitting up. He still looks very pale.
It's hardly surprising after what he's been through.
Mr. Powell?
Yeah. Bit of a celebrity, Mr. Powell. You don't mind me telling Mr. Rushton here about your magnificent achievement, do you, Mr. Powell? Ah, of course not. Came over, what was it, 20 years ago, was it? 20 years. 10-pound pond. Just after the war. Hard worker, good bloke, saved his scratch, bought himself a little farm back at Burke. Then he bought out his neighbour, then another neighbour, and pretty soon the only way he can get around the place is in a plane, little Mooney. Was it a Mooney or a Cessna? Fairly sure it was a Mooney. Anyway, one night, him and his wife were up in the plane going into Sydney for some event, some celebration or other, and a big storm came over. Visibility down to zero, instruments all at sixes, and he's all over the shop. In the end, he comes down and smacks into a tree. Bits all over the place. Wife doesn't make it, poor thing.
Good for.
And he's hurt pretty bad, so he goes off into the bush looking for help. He's gone for 47 days. Well, believe that, 47 days out there in the bush. I mean, this is a pond. Done a bit of farming, but deep down, he's a city boy. No bushcraft, nothing like that. Anyway, after 47 days out there, shows up at a sheep station. Walking skeleton, half skinned by the sun. Big gash in his arm, bruise the size of a melon on the side of his head, but he's still walking. 47 days on berries and slime must be some sort of record. Had a huge write-up in the Herald. You should write a book, Mr. Powell. Like, Biggles. Is that the kettle?
Don't think so.
So you're what?
Undertaker of some sort?
Oh, no. No, not at all. No, this is just a one-off thing.
So what line of work are you in?
Well, in some respects, I suppose I plough a similar furrow to Mr. Hancock.
You're a comedian?
I dabble. Next to Mr. Hancock's, my minuscule talent pales into insignificance, but I draw cartoons, I do little skits and so forth on television, earning the odd crust here and there.
Yeah, you said, no disrespect, but if you ask me, this is the problem with the world nowadays.
What is?
Everybody's a bloody comedian.
Well, I wouldn't say everybody. Yeah, I mean, David Frost does his best, but I've always found his manner somewhat too unctuous to be commensurate with real comic talent. And I know many who do, but I've never found any amusement value at all in Charlie Drake.
But you did in Mr. Hancock.
He was a great comic, much loved by millions.
What was he doing over here?
He was making a new series for Australian television, Hancock Down Under. It was Hancock's attempt to conquer a new world. He'd failed to crack the American market, so he came here, a clean slate, fresh start, a young country where perhaps one's own youth can be recaptured. It's what most Poms who come here are looking for, I suppose. That and the drink, and the cheap housing, and the weather and the beaches. And people say class doesn't matter here, which doesn't mean much to a toff like me. But Hancock, I believe, was from Birmingham. Poor chap.
So did he make the television shows?
He did, yes. 3 episodes, I believe. They were not, by all accounts, Hancock's finest hour, or Hancock's finest half hour. Come to that.
They weren't funny.
Not very. No. Uncomfortable to watch, is the general view.
I bet he was funny before.
Oh, yes. He made people laugh.
How?
What
was his comic technique?
It's difficult to analyse, really. Wry observation of the human condition, I suppose. Exposing petty hypocrisies and... is that the kettle?
It's the rolling boil we're after. There she blows.
Ah.
I actually have a highly developed sense of humour.
Do you?
I prefer not to indulge it, but...
Best let it stand for a while.
Plato thought...
Plato?
Plato.
Plato the Greek...
The Greek philosopher. Plato. Plato thought that comedy and laughter in the ideal society should be banned or at least tightly controlled. And, of course, God never laughs.
You know this, do you?
Yeah, in the 750,000 words that make up the Holy Bible, there's just one mention of God laughing. Psalm 2, when the kings of the earth start getting above themselves. He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall have them in derision.
More of a ha than a ha-ha, then.
If you like. These days, you don't mind me talking frankly, do you? These days, people talk about the sense of humour as if it's a virtue, but it's not, is it?
It is widely regarded as such.
No, it's not a virtue. It's a deficiency. It's an inability to face up to real life. People make jokes out of this, jokes out of that. In the end, there's nothing left. You can see it in their eyes. There's a spiritual vacuum. I've seen it 1,000 times. The life and soul of the party, the office wag, the bloke on the telly, gradually ha-haing their lives away till there's nothing there. How'd he kill himself?
Vodka and pills.
There you are, then.
And, this spiritual vacuum, you see it in my eyes, you?
Not really, no. Then again, you don't strike me as very funny. How strong do you like your tea?
A Victorian mahogany.
Oh, I'll leave it a minute longer. Go on, then.
What?
Be funny.
What?
Tell us one of your jokes.
The thing is, I don't really do jokes as such.
Tell us one of Mr. Hancock's jokes, then. Go on.
Tell us one of the jokes he was much loved for. Tell you what, if you can make me laugh with one of his jokes, I'll issue a one-off permit allowing you to carry him onto the plane.
The thing is, Mr. Hancock didn't really do jokes either.
I see. One minute you say he was funny.
Mr. Hancock's humour was more comedy of character. Having established the character, he'd be cast loose in some situation that explores the juxtaposition of incongruities, and a duck goes into a chemist shop.
Is this a joke?
Look, a duck goes into a chemist shop and says, "Do you have any lip salve?"
This is one of Mr. Hancock's jokes.
No, it's just a joke I heard. A duck goes into a chemist shop, says, "Do you have any lip salve?" And the chemist says, "Certainly, sir. How would you like to pay?" And the duck says, "Ugh."
Hello? Healy. Yes, yes, I know. No, we have this clearly arranged, Healy. You are going to pick Uncle Teddy up at the station in a taxi, take him home, give him a meal, then you can go to Mona's and I'll play dominoes with him. Of course I can't, because I don't get off work until 5 and then... Yeah, well, you're going to have to phone Uncle Teddy then and tell him to catch a later train. Yes? Yes. Call me back. Yes. Bloody woman.
Mrs. Foster?
No, I'm not married. With my sister, Hilly. I live with my sister. Bloody woman.
Oh, poor, shall I?
They won't see sense, will they? I mean, what do you think? Uncle Teddy's coming down from Newcastle. He's 73, not a well man, but it's not as if he's demanding. Just needs somebody to take him about a bit. Buy a St. Bruno, food on the table, game of dominoes. Somehow, him and Ellie rub each other up the wrong way. Had a bit of a ding-dong last time he came down, so now Ellie's gone on strike. So she won't lift a finger for the old bastard. I mean, is that reasonable? Mona. Mona puts her up to it.
Mona?
Her friend, Mona the man-hater.
Lesbian?
No, we don't have them in Australia. Anyway, finish your joke. Duck's in the chemist shop.
I fear the moment may have passed.
No, go on.
See, the thing is with the joke...
I know, your timing's shot to pieces. I just want to know the end, the punchline. That's the terminology, isn't it? Punchline?
So the duck goes into the chemist shop, says, "Have you got any lip salve?" The chemist says, "Certainly, sir, right here. How would you like to pay?" And the duck...
Budgie. Be better if it was a budgie.
In what sense?
Instead of the duck. Budgies can talk. Ducks just quack. If it was a budgie instead of a duck, it'd make the story just that little bit more believable.
I'd have thought that of the many levels of disbelief one is required to suspend in order for the joke to work... A duck with a broad general knowledge of non-prescription pharmaceuticals and so on, the duck's ability to speak would be the least significant.
Every little helps.
Yes, but you don't... There's a... Yes, yeah, of course, a budgerigar would be better. OK, a budgie goes into a chemist shop...
And you make your living doing this sort of thing.
Was that Mr. Powell?
Take him his tea.
Your tea's here, Mr. Powell.
Not feeling so good again. He's having another lie down.
Hardly surprising, I suppose, after what he's been through.
What's that?
47 days in the bush.
Oh, no, that was ages ago.
Oh, I assume that was why he was going back to Blighty.
No. It was the other business made him want to go back to Ruislip.
Ruislip.
Yeah, that's where he's from. You know?
Oh, Ruislip.
See, after his ordeal, he was in the hospital for a good while. Then he went back to his farm and took up where he left off. But, you know, not much oomph in him. He was still under the doctor. Only the doctor couldn't do anything for him. It was his mind, you see. Thing like that. But then another little miracle. Doctor got this new receptionist, Amy. She did more good for him than a sink full of pills. Lovely girl. They got married, and he took her back to the farm. Then about 6 months later, he goes into Sydney on some business, and when he comes back, she's gone. He didn't know what had happened. There was no note, nothing. So he gets up a search party with the neighbours. They look all over. Eventually, they find her in the pigsty. What was left of her, anyway. The pigs that ate her.
Good Lord.
Picked her bones clean.
I didn't realise pigs did that.
Oh, mate. They'll eat anything you put in front of them, but they're not usually known to bring down live human prey. What they reckon must have happened was that maybe she tripped over while she was feeding the pigs, hit her head or something. Either that or she'd taken a funny turn.
Was there a post-mortem?
On a pile of bones, what could they do? So after that, our Mr. Powell was a broken packet of biscuits. A man of straw. Sold the farm and he's off back to Ryslip. Although, what's there for him, I don't know.
Well, I suppose Ryslip has a certain potential as a place where a man can forget. Although, primarily, you'd want to forget the misfortune of finding himself in Ryslip.
Do you think I should confiscate his necktie, belt and shoelaces? I mean, it would be an impertinence on a non-custodial visitor, but he does seem very low.
He'd feel a good deal worse if his trousers fell down.
Mm. Wonder what happened to Lance. Sonny, I hope he's given a jump over to Pat's office to get the keys and then over here.
Yeah.
No answer. Well, he'll be on his way over, I expect. That's your flight? I wouldn't worry. Lance will be here in plenty of time.
We still haven't resolved the question of the ashes.
Yeah, I'm surprised you haven't made a joke out of that.
What, some sort of cricket reference?
Taking the ashes home?
Yes.
I'd have thought a thing like that.
Yes, it's a joke waiting to happen.
People would laugh at that, for sure.
Yes. Yeah, when I saw Hancock a couple of months ago, we mostly talked about cricket.
You like cricket, didn't
you? Oh, yes.
Well, that's something, I suppose. He was a good friend of yours?
Oh, not at all. No. The first time I met him was here in Sydney. We had dinner together. I actually approached the evening with some trepidation because, truth to tell, he had every right to punch me on the nose.
Yeah?
You see, some years ago, I used to do this cartoon strip. A thing called Aesop Revisited, sort of moral fables for modern times. And one of them was about Hancock. He'd had, you see, this massive success on radio and television. Public loved him. Critics loved him. Then hubris got the upper hand. He decided to abandon TV for film. Made a film. Wasn't a success. So he sacked his writers, Ray Galton and Alan Simpson. God bless them. And they'd written all those radio and TV shows and the film. And what they'd done, they'd adapted his own personality into this comic persona that made him so successful. But he didn't want to be this comic persona anymore, which was unfortunate because that, more or less, was exactly who he was. Galton and Simpson had given him the toxic gift of seeing himself as others saw him. But he didn't want to be himself anymore. He wanted to be Chaplin or Grimaldi, wanted to be a legend. And of course, this vaunting ambition was merely another aspect of his comic self, so the more he tried to escape the comic persona, the more he came to resemble it. He drank, did a series for ITV, it flopped. Drank some more, he did another film, it flopped. He drank some more. And I sort of put his mistakes, his arrogance, his hubris in this little cartoon strip. And it was, by all accounts, very hurt.
And you say this is for a kid's cartoon?
Oh, no. A magazine I started with some friends for grown-ups.
Oh, which one's that then?
It's called Private Eye.
Oh, I don't think I've come across that one.
No, you wouldn't have. The Australian censors have deemed it unsuitable for Antipodean sensibilities and banned it. The only context in which my name might be bracketed with those of J.D. Salinger, D.H. Lawrence and Hugh Hefner.
Is it a filthy magazine?
Depends on your definition of filth.
Liable to corrupt and pervert. Does it provoke base passions?
I wouldn't have thought so. Not in England, anyway. The English climate does rather mitigate against that sort of thing. Passion, you see, requires both bars of the electric fire, an extravagance few Englishmen are prepared to tolerate.
What is this magazine, then?
I suppose, for want of a better word, one would have to call it satirical.
Satirical? Isn't that a form of communism?
No.
Yes, it is. It's a form of communism.
No, it isn't.
Does your magazine denigrate our democratically elected ministers of state?
Remorselessly.
Does it make mockery of revered social institutions?
That is its sort of raison d'etre, if you'll pardon my French.
Do you mind if I have a look through your luggage, Mr. Rushton?
Is that absolutely necessary?
Just to be sure.
Of what?
No items of contraband, no drugs, material relating to communism, contraception or other subjects of a subversive or obscene nature?
I'm on my way out of the country.
And?
So if you were to find any such items, in a sense, I'd be doing you a favour by removing their infection from your soil.
But you're not out of the country yet, are you?
Yes,
and possession of such items while you're on Australian soil is an indictable offence.
Ugh. Go on, then. Those are my underpants. As you can see, they are standard issue Y-fronts in greyish white with no telltale hammer and sickle on the label.
Huh?
Those are my shaving things. The soap, as you see, is from Trumper's Gentleman's Barbers and smells of leather and cedar and other manly odours with not a hint of anything to suggest homosexual inclinations. That, on the other hand, is a pink shirt. You got me banged to rights, Gov. I'll come quietly.
What's this?
What?
This book.
Ah, that's a little something of my own, I fear.
I didn't know the way to King's Cross when I first came here, but look at me now. Book. That's the title.
Indeed.
By William Rushton, author, artist, and beer drinker.
All three epithets exaggerations, especially by Australian standards, the last. In the pooking parlours of Darlinghurst Road, I could easily pass as a Quaker.
This is a book you wrote about Australia.
Oh dear, this isn't going to end well, is it?
You know the country, do you? Spent a lot of time here.
The young lady I'm now happy to call my fiancée lives here.
You're engaged?
Yes.
To an Australian girl?
Yes.
You asked her to marry you?
Yes.
And she said yes?
Yes. Do you think there might be another cup of tea in here?
Chapter 2... Politics and Censorship, Chapter 3, and while we're on the subject, God.
It's a very short book, no more than an overweight pamphlet.
Chapter 6, Vietnam.
Ah.
Australia is in Vietnam to defend Darwin and the free world as we know it from the yellow peril, or the red-yellow peril, the orange peril indeed, and conscripting Australian youths to go there. Take precautions. Sugar your urine daily or remove a foot for crying out loud.
Look, I do appreciate there might be a range of views on the matter.
Were you in the armed forces, Mr. Rushton?
2 years, national service.
Did you see action?
I saw Ava Gardner in The Barefoot Contessa and Marilyn Monroe in River of No Return, which was about all the excitement I could stand.
Were you an officer?
In the ranks, where I learned my trade.
What trade?
Taking the piss. It's what the army was made for.
I served in the AIF during the war. I was up in Darwin when the Japs came. Do you know, more bombs were dropped on Darwin on the night of 19th of February 1942 than were dropped on Pearl Harbor 2 months earlier?
Oh?
My late father lost an eye at Magdeba. Uncle Teddy left half his stomach at Gallipoli. My family has always defended this country, and I intend to keep defending it, Mr. Rushton, to keep it safe and to keep it wholesome.
I'll, repack my underpants. I may.
Chapter 13. Royalty. You don't care how offensive you are, do you?
I think you'll find it's a very balanced chapter.
Balanced?
I take the piss out of Australian Republicans as well as the monarchists.
Listen. 3rd of March, 1963. Royal Agricultural Showground at Moor Park. Her Majesty the Queen with the Duke of Edinburgh attended a pageant of nationhood. It poured with rain, but all the same, 30,000 people turned out in that shocking downpour and they raised a cheer you could hear from D.Y. to Sutherland. I'm not too proud to admit I cried like a newborn. She was a vision. She wore a long, shiny dress, cloak around her shoulders and a crown on her head, a tiara, and these 5 huge emeralds in a necklace and white gloves. Beautiful skin, radiated wholesomeness. Every inch of that woman said, Queen. She was a queen. I was fairly near the front and it was like she smiled right at me. I dream about that smile. Oh, I know. In swinging, satirical London, the monarchy's probably no more than one of your jokes. But over here, we, well, most of us anyway, we still see that great lady as embodying a standard. A standard of decency, of wholesomeness. You're worse than him, really, aren't you?
Hancock?
Danny, the deserter. There's a war going on. Not just in Vietnam, everywhere. People fighting for what's right. I know you think my ideas are old-fashioned. That's not the point. The point is, whatever your ideas, there's work to be done. But rather than rolling up your sleeves and getting on with it, you just run away, like Danny, to your jokes, and you're sneering like a bloody school kid, yes? Hilly, you've... What? Good. What time? Good, right. Well, at the moment, I'm locked in my office. It's a long story. Yes, I should be out in time. Yes, I'll pick him up. What about his dinner? What are you talking about? Well, can't you leave something on a low light? Well, what am I supposed to do then? I can't take him to the RSL, can I? There's nothing there he could eat. Or the banquet in a bun. You know very well, rice, fish, eggs, and that's his lot. Hilly, you don't seriously expect me... Oh, for crying out loud. I barely know where the kitchen... Oh, Hilly! Bloody woman. Oh, that'll be Lance. Here's your book, pack up your things. The flight will be called soon. Lance! Oh, brought the MPs with you. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Would you find
it? Yeah. Up jumped the flag, man. Sprang into the billabong. You'll never take me alive, said he. And his ghost can be heard every time you pass that billabong. You'll come a waltzing Matilda with me.
He's still here. Plane leaves in 15 minutes.
Did you find Danny the deserter?
No. Probably halfway up O'Riordan Street by now, finding some students up at the university to take him in. But at least there's no chance of getting out of the country, so that's my job done.
Good.
You'd better get a move on.
You see, comedy is the only way of expressing human understanding in all its slipperiness without resorting to poetry or diagrams. It's where two ideas meet in the brain and cause a tiny little explosion that's nevertheless so powerful that it has the physical consequence of making you go, ha, repeatedly.
If you miss this run, there's no more direct flights until tomorrow.
And what makes the ideas explode is that they don't belong in the same bit of your brain because they're contradictory or incongruous or daft. But for this little miracle to work, you have to have a brain that, far from being frightened by new ideas and contradictions, welcomes them in, gives them the run of the place, and offers them cake.
Yeah, look, there's a world of difference between being frightened by new ideas and being discerning.
One of the great delights available to the human mind is the discovery that something can be true and false at the same time, and there's nothing quite so magnificent as doubt.
Doubt's a luxury few of us can afford.
Not for Galileo's doubt, we'd still think the sun revolved around the earth, or whatever it was he said.
John Eccles from Melbourne did not win the Nobel Prize for persistent uncertainty.
Were it not for the scepticism of Darwin, after whom your jealously guarded city is named, we'd still think that all living things were made on a fun-packed Wednesday and Thursday, and mankind on a Friday.
Mark Oliphant from Adelaide did not create nuclear fusion from amusing ambiguities.
Doubt is the valiant hero that slays the vile dragons of prejudice, bigotry, arrogance, and tyranny. It is the great engine that propels the forward motion of civilization. Although I could, of course, be completely wrong about all of this.
You could, and you are. And you also need to study the difference between clever and smart-ass.
One teacup of rice to two of water. You might want to write this down.
What?
Simmer until the rice has absorbed the water, at the same time hard-boil two eggs. Chop the eggs, mix with the rice, and add a big chunk of butter and some flaked smoked haddock. Oh, no, not haddock, obviously. Flaked smoked barramundi.
Don't you ever get tired of your own honking?
The result is kedgeree. Usually there'd be spices added, but probably not recommended for a man with half his stomach in the Dardanelles.
Mm.
I want a letter of authorization to bear these ashes on board the aircraft with the dignity they deserve.
You're not getting it.
Passengers for the rescheduled BIC flight BA113... should now proceed to gate B to commence boarding.
That's you. Goodbye, Mr. Rushton.
You are doing a great man an even greater disservice.
You don't really care about him at all, do you?
What?
This bloke. You don't care about him at all. You've just got a bad conscience about your blessed cartoon.
I'm sure you're right. But this matter really has nothing to do with my guilt or your prejudices. It's a matter of... what's the use? One thing. You might want to explore the possibility that Mr. Powell ate both his wives.
What?
How does a man with no knowledge of bushcraft survive more than a month out there? Think about it. There is, I believe, no shortage of precedents. Indeed, in the event of a plane crash or shipwreck, it's pretty much de rigueur to snack on your fellow passengers. And I've heard that the taste of human flesh is one you never forget.
This is bulldust.
Good liars steer as close to the truth as possible. And the pig story also has the advantage of being barely feasible, which, of course, makes it perversely credible. Why would anyone make up such a bizarre story?
They probably started boarding.
Right. Just to put my mind at ease, the hold part, where you'll put the ashes, is it pressurised and heated?
It's usually pressurised, not usually heated.
So a living person down there on a long-haul flight would probably freeze to death?
I would have thought so.
Did you hear that, Daniel?
Eh?
You'd better hop out of the cabin trunk.
I don't want to hop out of the cabin trunk.
Is this some sort of conjuring trick?
From the dialogue, it says it's closer to a vent act. You'll freeze to death, Daniel. It's best you come out.
You, stay there. One false move and you'll get some of this. Give us your left hand. How the bloody hell did he get in there?
Open the lid and climbed.
I mean, in the luggage room. We both saw him go out the door. There. He locked it after him.
Then he ran around outside, very quietly let himself in through the window on which he'd already broken the lock and jumped in the cabin trunk, thereby expediting his removal from the country without any of the attendant bureaucracy, and looking forward to arriving in the UK a free, but, as it would have turned out, deep-frozen man.
Hello? Is Lance there? Can you get him? You better run if you're going to make that plane. Leave the urn here. I'll make sure it gets in the hold on time.
Yeah, I don't suppose begging would be any use. What about a bribe?
You disgust me.
And you're absolutely certain...
The plane won't take off without the ashes in the hold. I'll see to it personally. You didn't finish.
What?
The budgie. The duck.
I hated boys like you at Shrewsbury. Bullying by humiliation.
I've got the ashes.
And the chemist says... Certainly we have lip salve, sir, and how would you like to pay? And the duck says, just put it on my bill. Thank you, and good night.
Hello?
Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has turned off the no smoking and fasten seatbelt signs. Passengers in rows 19 to 29 may now smoke, and you may move around the cabin.
I'm sorry, sir, but this can't travel here.
No, I have a special dispensation from Mr. Foster, monarch of all that flies.
Yes, I know all about that. These are Mr. Hancock's ashes.
Yes.
And they really don't belong here, sir.
I went over all this with Mr. Foster.
They should be in first class, sir. I've got a seat prepared.
Oh, thank you. Yes, thank you. Thank you.
In Hancock's Ashes by Caroline and David Stafford. Willie Rushton was played by Ewan Bailey. Brian Foster by Richard Delane. Daniel the Deserter by Paul Heath. And the stewardess was Rosalind Hill. The director was Mark Beebe.
If you'd like to receive our newsletter with full details of the week's radio dramas, just search for BBC Radio Drama Newsletter.